Penguin Random House Audio presents Directorate S, The CIA and America's Secret Wars in Afghanistan and Pakistan, by Steve Cole. Read for you by Malcolm Hilgartner. In memory of Robert and Shirley. Everybody knows that the dice are loaded. Everybody rolls with their fingers crossed. Everybody knows that the war is over. Everybody knows that the good guys lost. Leonard Cohen, Everybody Knows, 1988. Author's note. Two extraordinary colleagues contributed deeply to this book. Christina Sikowski, who earned an undergraduate degree at Wellesley College and a master's degree at Georgetown University, carried out important interviews and document analysis for more than 2 years. She was singularly responsible for the rich interviews that inform Chapter 26, among many contributions. I could not have finished the book without her. The same is true of Elizabeth Barber, a graduate of the Honors College at the State University of New York, who also earned a master's degree from Columbia University's Graduate School of Journalism. Among other things, Elizabeth carried out a 9-month fact-check of the manuscript, recontacting sources, and reaching out to new ones. She used this reporting to improve the manuscript from start to end, adding new scenes and revelations, and pushing tirelessly for accuracy, nuance, and completeness. Although I am solely responsible for what appears in these pages, Directorate S belongs to Christina and Elizabeth as much as it does to me. There are other important colleagues from Columbia and elsewhere who made vital contributions. I thank them all. Introduction. In 1989, I moved to New Delhi for the Washington Post to become the newspaper's South Asia correspondent. I was 30 years old and responsible for a phantasmagoria of news from India, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, and Nepal. For 3 years, I hopped from capital to capital and from one guerrilla war, coup d'etat, and popular revolution to another. It was thrilling and affecting work. In Afghanistan, the last units of the Soviet occupation forces had recently pulled out of the country. The war caused by the Soviet invasion had claimed an estimated 1 to 2 million Afghan lives, or up to 10% of the pre-war population. Landmines and indiscriminate bombings maimed hundreds of thousands more. About 5 million Afghans became refugees. Soviet and Afghan communists purposefully decimated the country's educated elites, executing or exiling traditional leaders. By the time I turned up, this culling had left much of the field to radical preachers and armed opportunists. In Kabul, the Soviets had left behind a few thousand KGB officers and military advisers to prop up a regime led by Mohammad Najibullah, a physician-turned-secret police chief. Najibullah's forces controlled the Afghan capital and an archipelago of cities. The countryside belonged to the Mujahideen, the anti-communist rebels funded and armed by the CIA, as well as by Pakistani and Saudi intelligence. The war had settled into a grinding stalemate. The Soviet troop withdrawal knocked the Afghan story off front pages and network broadcasts in the United States, but for the Post, it remained a matter of running interest, not least because the CIA was still smuggling guns and money to the rebels. The agency's career officers and analysts were among our subscriber base in Washington. Like other correspondents in those years, I covered the Afghan war from both sides. I flew periodically to Kabul to interview Najibullah and his aides, or to travel around the country with Afghan communist generals. From Pakistan, I went over the border to see the Islamist rebels' hold on the countryside. The work was generally safe, as correspondence from a medium-grade civil war goes. Yet during this period, Western reporters and humanitarian workers learned to be wary of the loose bands of Arab Islamist volunteers circulating among the Afghan Mujahideen. These international radicals sometimes staged roadside executions of non-believers they came across. We did not yet know them as Al-Qaeda. The CIA subcontracted its aid to the Afghan rebels through Pakistan's main spy agency, Inter-Services Intelligence, or ISI. By 1989, the service had grown into a powerful, corrosive force within Pakistan, a shadowy deep state that manipulated politics on behalf of the army and increasingly promoted armed groups of Islamists, including the Arab volunteers we had learned to approach cautiously. ISI officers were not easy to meet, but not impossible to track down either. I became somewhat obsessed with reporting on the underbelly of the Afghan conflict. I wrote for the Post about how the CIA program to arm the rebels functioned, why its escalation had helped to defeat the Soviet occupation, and how, simultaneously, CIA's covert action had empowered the more radical factions in the rebellion, largely at ISI's direction. In December 1991, the Soviet Union collapsed. The political upheavals in Moscow and Central Asia rippled into Afghanistan. Soviet cash, food, and arms supplies to Najibullah's government looked to be finished. This altered the civil war's balance. By late April 1992, the fall of Kabul to the ISI-backed Islamist rebels seemed imminent. I flew in. The Mujahideen flowed into the capital unopposed on a Saturday. Kabul's wary residents had been governed for a decade by an officially secular regime. Hoping to avoid a bloodbath, they greeted the entering long-bearded rebels with flowers. Najibullah tried to flee but was arrested at the airport. His security forces took off their uniforms, abandoned their posts, and went home, trying to blend into the new order. The Mujahideen seemed uncertain initially about whether to trust their acceptance into Kabul. That first day of the takeover, I met a rebel straggler near the zoo. He said his name was Sayed Munir. He was carrying an assault rifle. He turned in circles and insisted that anyone who wished to talk to him do so from a distance of 10 feet. "Everyone is friendly," he admitted, "but maybe some people want to take my gun." He was right to be wary. That night, a new round of war erupted among factions of the Afghan rebels. The fighting soon shredded Kabul, claimed thousands more innocent lives, and consigned Afghanistan to yet deeper poverty and international isolation. America, by now absorbed by victory in the Cold War and startling geopolitical changes such as the reunification of Germany, looked away. I moved on as well, to London, to take up a position as an international investigative correspondent for the Post. I was stationed there on February 26, 1993, when a cabal of jihadists, some with ties to the Afghan war, detonated a truck bomb beneath the World Trade Center, killing 6 people and wounding many others. My editors asked for an investigation into the networks of Islamist radicals and financiers that seemed to lie behind the World Trade Center attack. I worked on some of that project with another reporter, Steve Levine. We heard about a wealthy Saudi exile in Sudan, Osama bin Laden, who was reported to be funding some of the groups we were looking into. Steve flew to Khartoum to ask for an interview. Bin Laden's bodyguard said he would not be available. After speaking with some of bin Laden's aides and many other supporters and members of the jihadi movement from London to the Balkans to the Middle East, we wrote, "Arguably, the best way to think about bin Laden's multi-story Khartoum guest house is not as a centralized string-pulling headquarters, but as one among many scattered centers of gravity where militant Islamic radicals may find haven, succor, or support." We still had not heard of Al-Qaeda. Because of bin Laden's rising notoriety, the United States soon pressured Sudan to kick him out of Khartoum. He went to Afghanistan in the summer of 1996, declared war on the United States, and soon found shelter with the Taliban. By 2001, I had become the Post's managing editor in Washington. That spring, the paper carried coverage of the New York trial of jihadi conspirators who had participated in the terrorist attacks on 2 U.S. embassies in Africa in August 1998. The prosecutors introduced evidence of bin Laden's involvement in the terrorist plot, as well as his leadership of Al-Qaeda, which was at last identified publicly. A defector testified in detail about how Al-Qaeda worked and how bin Laden and
sample complete. Ready to continue?